I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
So my next interview is coming out of the Toronto International Film Festival. I'm not sure exactly how many films I was able to do this year, how many interviews I was able to complete, but it's over 20 at least, and it's amazing what you can get done from a home studio. And even before the festival begins, I was able to talk with our next guest, Nicole Dorsey, about her new film, Black Conflux, a Canadian film. Quote, "The seemingly separate lives of an anxious, disillusioned teen girl and a troubled, alienated man converge fatefully in this haunting exploration of womanhood, isolation, and toxic masculinity set in 1980s Newfoundland." Close quote. It really is an 80s film. The music is there to see, to hear, and a lot of attention to detail to see. I mean, how can you not like a film that highlights Gowan and Moonlight Desires? This is a coming of age story for sure, but it's a deeply existential for me piece and a philosophical film. Really, it's about a search for this young woman's identity and this young man as well, really. And Nicole talks a great deal about how she's sort of obsessed with this idea of fate, how this is about for her and for the characters in this film fitting into certain molds and kind of rejecting them at the same time. I thought that there was a real wisdom and a maturity to the performances here in this film, and I think that speaks to Nicole's work as a writer and a producer and a director, but also to the actors as well. Nicole talked a great deal about how important it is to move the camera, and I think you're going to have to see the film to really get an understanding for why that's the case. This is a film about empathy and uncertainty, and it's about reflecting on the present and, of course, living in the present while looking back at the past. Nicole told me too, in a really candid, a candid conversation about how she always needed to know more and yet at the same time always had so many more questions. Sounds a lot like me. I feel like, you know, there's so much more, not only interesting conversation in a question, but there's more discovery to be found. There's mystery at the same time. It gets us to another level and a new place in our conversation and our understanding, and hopefully in our knowledge as well. But it also opens up so many other doors. So I wanted to say thanks to Nicole for her candor and for this film, Black Conflux. I really enjoyed it, and it's something you're going to want to definitely get out to see. Don't touch that dial. Coming right up with Nicole shortly, DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my writing and my speaking. You can book me there. You can also get a hold of a copy of my book, Real Change is Incremental. You can purchase that through Amazon. And face2facelive.ca, so many more interviews there. You can go back a couple of years into our past. We're coming up on 500 interviews. Our 300th interview was with George Strombolopoulos, which was a real treat and pleasure for me to do. I can't believe that was almost 200 interviews ago. So look into our past. And if you want to support the work we're doing, you can do that through Patreon.com. newdotcom. I've set up a page there. You can support us monthly, $1, $5, $10, $20 a month to help us cut costs, I suppose, but also cover costs here at Face to Face, because we do have some of those. And if you can't do that, I get that. I understand. Please leave us a review on iTunes. I really would appreciate that. And forward the podcast to your friends. Sign up for the newsletter. Post us on Twitter, socialize this podcast to death, if you don't mind. We would really appreciate it. Get it up on Facebook. And you can also advertise here in our newsletters. We have a decent database, and we send out a newsletter once a month. We've got banner ads on the website and shoutouts in the actual interviews themselves. So do reach out to us if you're interested in reaching out to our demographic, which is quite wide now, listened to in about 20 countries, and most of our listeners in Canada, the US, and the UK. But go as far southeast as Cambodia. We were into China, Singapore. It's really quite remarkable, the places where people listen to Face to Face. And also, don't forget Rabble.ca for a whole host of other interviews with podcasters and bloggers and writers. Not just interviews, by the way, but news for the rest of us. It's a platform that I exist on. Face to Face is on, and you can dig into issues that matter with a whole plethora of people there who are writing about issues that matter. News for the rest of us. Rabble.ca. But don't touch that dial. Coming right up, Nicole Dorsey about her new film, Black Conflicts. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here with us today. In fact, I think this might be my first interview for the Toronto International Film Festival. We have Nicole Dorsey here with us to talk about her new film, Black Conflicts. Nicole, thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course. Yeah, happy to be here.
Hey, and you know what? Generally, let's just get this right. Did I pronounce your last name right? Normally, I ask that offline. Did I get it right?
Yeah, Dorsey. Yeah, okay. I think it's a pretty straightforward name. I would love somebody to mispronounce it, though.
Oh, is that right? Eh? Wait, would that just like add to the storyline?
I guess so. It'd be funny. I think it'd be pretty funny because I don't know how else. I guess you could say like Dorsey.
You could say it Dorsey. That's very proper.
Yes, it's very proper. And I have seen it spelt with an A at the end. I'm reading a true crime novel that's based in Toronto, and there's Dorseys in it. So I was like, okay, all right, new swing on it.
Okay, well, maybe the beginnings of a new film. Got to start doing, get into some genealogies here, go back into your history, find out how your name is actually connected. And we got a new screenplay in the making.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about the film, and tell us, you're coming to TIFF. TIFF is around the corner, I would imagine anticipating some new people you're going to meet, new experiences, the Q&As, the interviews, the craziness of it all. Talk a little bit about that if you don't mind, and then maybe just sort of give us a little bit of perspective on the film. By the way, congratulations on the film. I absolutely loved it. I mean, it's beautiful to watch. It's compelling. It's thoughtful. The performances are great. There's this tension throughout that was frankly kind of threw me off a little bit. And I so love the way it sort of wraps up, but not. did I give anything away there?
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. It could still go many ways at the end. I think in terms of, the events at TIFF itself and the screening, it's pretty wonderful to be back in my hometown to premiere. It's like a homecoming for me. My parents get to be there. I think some of my family is very excited to come. And I've been living in LA for the past 3.5 years. So it feels good to kind of come full circle and be in Toronto for the festival. I mean, I've attended for so many years, especially when I lived in the city. This film is very much a labor of love to be able to have our world premiere at a festival like TIFF. Me and the whole team were pretty stoked about it. And the Talent Lab is great too. I've applied for so many years, so it's kind of amazing to get in the year my film is also playing. So it really like has all come together for this 1 year at TIFF. And the film itself, it's a haunting story. It's something that I started thinking about back in like 2010 when I was traveling to Newfoundland and hitchhiking around, and I became obsessed with this idea of fate, the coming together of two lives, and how do two people from seemingly different worlds collide. And from there, the story began to morph, and I went back to Newfoundland. I made a short film in 2014 just based on Dennis. And then I finished the script in like 2015. So, I mean, really, like, it's a story of two characters. Jackie is this coming of age teen who's discovering her, you know, sexuality, her, you know, her own identity. And Dennis, in some ways, is doing the same thing. I mean, he's a bit more on a darker path, but how his trajectory is shaped and changed by the culture that surrounds him, how media shapes perspectives, especially when it comes to masculinity and femininity. So really, it's about these two characters who are on a journey for identity, and that brings them together in this sort of cosmic way.
There's something really deeply, to me anyway, deeply philosophical and kind of existential about the whole film. You know, I mean, on some levels, some listeners might, oh, wow, great, they're going all academic on us. But other listeners who know me, but I did a couple degrees in philosophy. So I do resonate with the darker, the more melancholic. And there's a tension in this film that right out of the gate. And it seems to be there in the performances. It seems to be there in the cinematography and the music. Is that you coming out? Is that some of your, you know, as writer, producer, director, some of that, your own existential angst, tension, or unanswered questions, maybe? I don't know. I would just really interested.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Everything I write seems to have some sort of like darker tone to it at some point.
Some kind of autobiography, I suppose, yeah. Right? I mean, how can it not, I suppose?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, my growing up does not fully reflect Jackie's. You know, I have my parents are married. I grew up as an only child in like suburbia in Ontario. So there's differences there. But I think this search for identity and being shaped by what's around you and trying to fit certain molds, but also rejecting them at the same time as you struggle to find your voice. Like as a teen, I was really obsessed with this idea of knowing exactly who I was. Of like deciding it in that moment, and that's who I'd be for the rest of my life, which as an adult, I kind of laugh at. But there's a lot of myself in Jackie. But, you know, in the film too, of course, I can get all heady and talk about all these concepts and motifs that are in it. But I also hope that it's entertaining. You know, that's definitely an ambition when I make films. I hope that people can watch it and be like, whoa, I don't know how I was affected by that, but something hit me.
Would that be something that you know, I've heard filmmakers say before, you know, they do their commercial work to really fund, you know, you referred to this film as a labor of love. I would imagine, you know, a passion project as well could sort of fit there. I'd love to hear more about that actually, but does that drive you, or is it more about that sort of commercial? Hey, I want lots of people to see this, but also to, you know, have people asking a few questions as they walk out of the theater or watch the film?
I mean, this film for me, it is a personal piece. I would love for people to walk out and feel like they were entertained or sparked, but also think. One of the, you know, notes of feedback we've been getting is the film, you know, they have a feeling when they walk out of the theater, but it's something that hits them the following day or two.
Right.
Which I like. I like this sort of slow burn and making you think. But yeah, I also didn't want to make like a super boring think piece. So
I don't think it's a boring think piece at all. I think it's really engaging and entertaining and beautiful to look at as well. The landscape, the, you know, just everything, the way it's pieced together is really, it's really compelling filmmaking. I mean, there's a sense of and I think it comes out in Jackie's character as well. There's a wisdom and a maturity there. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
Oh, absolutely. Ella is incredible. And we worked, you know, for a while before we started shooting, and she kind of came on a journey with me in unwrapping this character and figuring out how Jackie speaks and moves, and brought that to the table. And when we got to set, it was a dream. You know, I think all that prep work really gave us flexibility to hone in on performance when we were on set. And same with Ryan, who plays Dennis. You know, it's a hard character to play. I personally have a lot of empathy for Dennis. And I hope when watching him, you know, there's moments where you're like, this guy sucks. And there's other moments where you're like, oh, he's just the little boy who's lost.
Right.
And that's a hard, you know, that's a hard character to play, to ride that line and to have all that nuance. And Ryan really, he really crushed it. And I don't know, I was blessed by the casting, and we made a really good team.
I love how, just to go a little lighter here for a second, because I totally agree with you. The performances are astounding. They really are. They're just stellar. Really draw you in right from the get-go. But the 80s music, the 80s Canadian music. Come on. Gowan, oh, Moonlight Desires. By the way, that's a beautiful scene. The lighting, and it's just so gorgeous. It's so, so well pieced together. But yeah, the 80s Canadian music is awesome. Well, a little 70s too, I think. Did I hear a bit of April Wine in there as well?
There's some April Wine, because there's, you know, there's a few bands that were really big in Newfoundland at the time.
Okay.
Because I did try to be authentic to the place.
Right.
And there was, you know, Newfoundland being, and especially at that time when it's a little more hard to travel and whatnot, April Wine was one of the bigger bands that actually toured to Newfoundland when they did their Canadian tour. So they were quite big over there in the 80s. So I had to include some of their, a few of their tracks.
Did you go back and watch sort of coming of age films? Did you have a style in mind? Did you have a story in mind that you sort of thought you might kind of mirror to some degree, or not?
You know, I think there's several influences. I definitely am a sucker for like 70s American cinema. I, you know, kind of came up shaping my ideas about filmmaking. I love like how Paul Thomas Anderson moves the camera. I love, you know, early David Lynch films. You know, even like, I think in terms of performance, Andrea Arnold, like her work in getting those really authentic performances that feel so grounded and genuine have inspired me. But Robert Altman as well. You know, I love his work, and again, how he moves the camera. So I do find that I'm very visual in my storytelling, even though I tell these very very character driven film. I really do like to move the camera. So all of those definitely influenced me along the way. And I mean, we watched everything. Even with my production designer, you know, we put on like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which was great. It was a great reference piece visually for the production design. But then, you know, me and my DP also watched like, you know, films by Xavier Dolan and like Punch Drunk Love, or like the list kind of went on. We just really immersed ourselves. I think we also watched like Maniac as well at the time, that show, which I mean, he also moves the camera so well. So it was a lot. There was a lot kind of bubbling through our minds.
For me, just, and I'm going to show my age, I suppose, a little bit here, an early 80s film, Less Than Zero. I don't know if you remember it, but it just, for, there were a couple of scenes and a couple of moments. And I think this is what's so beautiful for me about film and storytelling and so on. It wasn't that there was anything specific, but it was, I think, a space that I was in. Does that make sense? I remember taking five people to see this movie and they didn't talk to me for weeks. Now maybe they hated it and, you know, and had good reason for that, but it was a coming of age story and it was early Robert Downey. I mean, I think he was 20 years old. It was a Bret Easton Ellis novel, maybe,
right.
82, 85. I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. But it had such an impact on me, poster framed on my wall, but it wasn't so much the film or the performances. I think it was what it was speaking to at the time. Isn't that a pretty marvelous thing about, you know, that experience of walking out of the theater? It's communal and yet so separate and distinct.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting. I love that. I actually have not seen Less Than Zero, but I love that it was made in 1987.
It had Andrew McCarthy and early. Oh, you got to go see it just for, you'll smile. Early James Spader and just an incredible performance, I think, by Robert Downey. But and you'll see some faces. Oh, hey, I didn't know he was in this film or she was in this film. But anyway, it's
interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, just again, that whole space, right. And how perspectival film is and why is it that someone loved this film and someone else didn't? Right?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. Well, it's funny that you talk about that. I just like The Graduate popped to my head. I love that film and this sort of existential dread of finding your place in the world. Is incredible. I think that film is definitely, that film spoke to me a lot.
So let's, if you don't mind, can we play with that a little bit, that existential dread, only because it comes, I think, through in such a compelling and interesting way and one that needs to be, you know, reflected on. And I think that the feedback that you're getting about people saying, oh, this is coming back to me, you know, the next day or a couple of days later. I mean, for me, that's the sign of a great piece. Why is it in some, you know, as young people grow up, and I'm going to talk mostly just about myself, I suppose, but I'm old enough also to be nostalgic. So why for some and not for others? So Jackie's got this wisdom and this worldliness about her that's just so rooted and grounded, it seems, and yet her friends don't. And then you look at Dennis's character and he seems to have some of that, but like you say, just this wounded, lonely boy that we're not quite sure where all this, what appears to be some pretty, pretty serious, you know, trauma or anger or whatever it is in his past bubbling up. Any thoughts on that as you were reflecting on the performances and even the writing of the film?
You know, I don't know what it is that makes the difference in people. I grew up always needing to know more. Like I needed answers and I don't know. I had such deep thoughts about the world and my place in it. And I remember talking a lot to my mother about these things, which sometimes she would very lovingly laugh at me to explain, like, you know, things will come to you. You're always changing. You're always evolving. There's no way. It's not like you get to the end of this race and there's all these answers there and you're done. You'll change every year of your life. And I don't know what that longing was. I think maybe perhaps there's discomfort in uncertainty. And some people just are more carefree in floating through it. I don't really know what makes the difference.
I'm kind of fascinated by the question too, and I don't know either. And I've asked lots of filmmakers because it's about your level of experience, I suppose, and what you're reading and what you're watching and the people you're hanging out with. I mean, we're so sort of nuanced and paradoxical, really, I suppose, in some respects. So it's not an either or kind of black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's what's so beautiful about film. What did Roger Ebert say? Empathy making machines. Movies were empathy making machines. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what's so beautiful about a film like yours? It allows us to step into this world in another way that hopefully, you know, gets us relating to other human beings well, to be entertained, absolutely, to be engaged, to say, wow, what a great film, but hopefully to wake up the next day with maybe a new thought or reflection or a new approach or a new question.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the hope. And even with, you know, Dennis's character, I've been, I recently read Bell Hooks' book, The Will to Change. And it's an incredible story about, I mean, really, at the end of the day, it's about empathy and making room for, well, in this case, because she's a feminist writer, in this case, making room and space for men to change who are, I guess, caught up in the patriarchy, and that patriarchy hurts men just as much as it hurts women in many respects. Right. And I love that thinking. So even with Dennis, you know, I think him being a complicated person, it's important to see empathy in him at various moments and potentially give space for him to change.
What do you think about filmmaking in Canada? Can you talk a little bit about that? I loved what you said earlier about you know, I called it a passion project. Labor of love.
Yeah.
Labor of love.
My labor of love.
Yeah. And you say that with, I can hear the smile. So clearly it was a good experience for you, but I would imagine also on some pretty significant levels, quite challenging. Yeah, I guess lots of questions there. How did you get through it? How did you manage it? How, you know, advice for others. Did you run up against things as a woman, you know, I would imagine that question's going to come up, especially with some of the the underlying tones in the film, but just interested to know what your experience was like.
Yeah. Well, this was, you know, the first time I had received telefilm funding, and we were blessed that we received regional fundings. I don't think we could have made this film I know we wouldn't have been able to make this film on the micro budget, or I guess it's called talent to watch now. So, I mean, it was very challenging in the sense of shooting a period piece with like 39 cast on the island of Newfoundland. So there's challenges of resources and crew and finances and simple things like the fact that there's no like big fabric stores on the island. So when you're thinking like you have to make drapes, but you
can't. Nicole, that would not have been the first thing on my list, by the way, from a challenger's perspective. I mean, but that's hysterical.
I mean, my poor production designer was like, "Oh God, where do I get stuff?" But I mean,
we had to fly in the drapes.
We actually, you know, what we did was we found locations that had the bones intact, and
right.
There are chunks of Newfoundland, especially the areas we shot, that haven't really updated since like the 70s. So the houses that we found were empty, but all the wallpaper, the carpet, the drapes, all of that was there. And then through being very resourceful, as Melanie is, we're able to fill everything. But yeah, that's challenging. Or at one point, our first AC had a family tragedy and had to leave the day before we started shooting. There's no other first ACs on the island, like none. So our second AC had to step up and do the role on day one of production.
Right out of the gate.
Right out of the gate. So there's things like that where you're like, oh God, there's no backups here. So that's challenging. And yeah, I think, you know, I think money is always relative, right? Sure. You're always going to feel like you don't have enough, unless maybe you're making like a Marvel movie or something. But yeah, it took a lot. And all my keys were the most dedicated people. And I don't think without them working overtime on this, we would have been able to pull it off. So it was a challenge, but we, you know, Telefilm and the Newfoundland Film Development Corporation also came in to help fund, and the Rocket Fund as well. I felt very, you know, blessed to have the money that we had on my first feature that's Canadian with no stars attached.
Was there any decisions you made to stray away from the script on set because of, you know, the way the story, the film was unfolding as you saw the performances, you know, I imagine it's got to be pretty exciting to sort of have this idea of what you think it's going to be. You write it down and then you, and then you actually start to, you know, to piece it together. I love the collaborative aspect of filmmaking, but I guess maybe the question is how much didn't make it into the film?
Right. Well, I cut a couple scenes for story reasons afterwards. But you know, there was a dream sequence that was actually written quite differently, than it is in the film. And originally, but it was going to cost a lot because there was like a whole scene with like a SWAT team thing that was meant to come in, and it was a bigger, and there was a plane and a propeller, and then he gets more drapes. Yeah, he gets sucked into the propeller, or his sister gets sucked into the propeller. It was big. It was a lot. And
right.
You know, I figured out a way that we could pull it off. But it was expensive, and it became, you know, one of those things where you're like, okay, how do I not compromise my creative vision? But also ensure that, you know, if we try and pull it off and we blow all this money and it's not to perfection, it's still going to compromise the vision. So right. What do we do here? So I think it's figuring out smart solutions to when you can't pull something off or when it's going to be an insane nightmare for various reasons. How to just maintain the intention. So I rewrote that scene, Dennis's little nightmare. I rewrote it with what we had available. It was still hard to pull off, but what we had available. And I think it's actually way better.
It's so cool, eh? Isn't that amazing? I love that about the sort of the creative process and your comment about intention. And I just thought of sort of the integrity of the piece too, right? And of the story and how much trust there's got to be with your editor and your DOP and all the, you know, the key. Oh, well, everybody, frankly.
Yeah.
From a storytelling perspective, because there's just, honestly, Nicole, there's a beautiful, a tragically beautiful tone throughout the film. Is that okay?
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, there really is, and it's not, it's never preachy. It's earnest, maybe, and just it's just so lovely and so real. And you know, I hung out with some of those people. You know what I mean? And I think that's a really wonderful thing that you've been able to capture. It's for me, it really is a film. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. A film about choice, about hopefully making, I suppose, better choices, or making choices maybe together. And I don't want to give away the end of the film and where you actually end up. But it's a road movie, I suppose. It's two different road movies kind of converging, I guess, for me a little bit. But yeah, I just wondered. Did you go in with that idea in mind that this is a film about, like, I mean, obviously coming of age, but about choice and intention?
You know, yes, in some ways, like, it definitely entered my mind, because I think as you kind of go through life, of course, there's this idea of, in terms of thinking the nature versus nurture, like, you are shaped by things around you. But again, it's the choices that you make. You know, I think of the story of like the two brothers who had an alcoholic father, and that's who they saw their whole upbringing. And one becomes an alcoholic and the other doesn't because they saw their father. And so kind of going through this, it's like, yes, there are things within their separate worlds that can shape them one way or the other, but ultimately it's the choice you make as an individual as you go along and learn. So, you know, just, it does call that into question. Dennis is very much surrounded by magazines that objectify women, He's in a, especially in the 80s, you know, this patriarchal world that's telling him this is what masculinity is, this is what you should live up to. But he is a participant in that as well.
Yeah, yeah, complicit to some degree, and clearly present and smart enough to sort of know better and yet be a part of this, I guess, just systemic dysfunction, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And this is what's so great about, I think, about your film. It's raising some pretty serious questions along the way while telling a fun and entertaining story and getting a little 80s and 70s Canadian music in there. So it's, that is a good thing. Was that hard to do to get the rights to use some of that music?
Some of it, you know, again, this like happy accidents, because there were other songs.
Hey, that could have been the title of the film, maybe. Yeah. Happy accidents.
That'd be amazing. Different kind of vibe.
That's right.
You know, I guess coming from this film, I feel like, you know, when things feel like they're not going right, and something else happens, it's for the best. Because we originally, the opening track, originally I'd written it as a Joni Mitchell song, this unreleased track of hers. And getting the rights, even though the song's not on any albums and was never released as a single or anything, proved pretty difficult. Mainly, I think, because Joni is aging and it's more difficult to get a hold of her.
Right.
But, you know, then I landed on this Linda Perhack song, which Jackie sings a cappella in the beginning of the movie. And it's perfect. Like, it couldn't
be
more perfect. It speaks to the tone of the whole film. It sets everything up in a way that Joni song didn't. And I still love that Joni song, but it just was different. And so that was meant to be. And, even Gowan, Gowan was an incredible piece to come across. I think Happy Accidents were definitely, I guess it didn't become an accident. I'd still pick those other songs, but.
Sure. Hey, just a little quick aside. I got to see Gowan about four or five times in the 80s. I had a friend who was like a crazy nut fan, and saw him at Massey Hall, went on a little bit of a 3-day road trip. I couldn't even tell you what year this was, but you got some very fond memories. So as soon as the song came on, it was that's what's so beautiful too, as you say. And by the way, when you referred to an 80s film as a period piece, I almost laughed out loud, but it's true, right?
It's true.
I grew up with that during that period. You know what I mean? It's just so funny, but it's so true. And I'm interested too in that as well, Nicole. I mean, sadly, we're gonna be wrapping up our conversation here in a couple of minutes, and loving every minute of it. But why the 80s? I mean, yeah, loved the music, loved whatever. But there had to have been. It seems to me there had to have been a bit more than that.
Was it deeper than that? Oh, of course. I think that it's easier sometimes to reflect on the present when we look at the past and see where we've come or where we still are. And so I like having that little bit of distance to be able to analyze. You know, there's a podcast that I love called Throughline, and that's what they do in that podcast. They talk about a current issue, but then they give historical context. And it makes us understand what's happening now so much more. For me, that's exactly why I wanted to dive into the 80s. Of course, it's visually super fun. There's a lot of devices that you can use in storytelling with, like, no cell phones, no technology, that sort of stuff is great to play with. But ultimately, when feeding into this narrative and you know, this reflection I wanted to create, it made sense.
Yeah, it's cool. I so love that the film is working on so many levels, and it just hit me kind of in a new way as I was sort of reflecting on the last drive in the film and the broken windshield and a couple questions around that. Again, do you step back and watch the film and go, wow, I didn't see that before? Or, wow, isn't it wild how that just became a part of the storytelling I don't know if that makes sense.
Oh, right, yeah, the windshield specifically.
Yeah, and you hold the shot. I think it's quite an extended shot.
Yeah, it's super long.
I love that kind of storytelling, and I just had to sort of smile in a kind of a sad way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, the windshield was pretty great. That's funny. Yeah, the windshield, I have to admit, I'd love to have been the one to break it for the look of that moment, but the car was a bit busted up. So it had that, which worked really well because the light reflects in it. Pretty amazing. And we found that car. I went to a bunch of car shows in Newfoundland and just met people and gave my business card and asked them if they wanted to put their car in a movie.
That's hilarious.
And Newfoundlanders are incredible people and like to participate and are welcoming. So this guy gave us his car obviously we rented it off of him, but he lent us his car so we could use it as our Dennis mobile.
Yeah. Well, I just love how this isn't what filmmaking is all about, but moving the story forward, driving the story forward. And do you, just to go back to that question as we sort of wrap up here, when you step back, and especially in relation to this, did you see sort of that intentionality coming out in ways that you weren't even aware of? Does that make sense?
Within his character, or?
Well, within the characters, the performance, like it's sometimes for, you know, and I've obviously never, you know, maybe not obviously, I haven't directed a film and neither have I written one, but on a second and third viewing, you go, oh, look at that. Oh, and you see connections and some people will say, well, that was just an accident. Well, like you said, it was a happy, you know, quote you, a happy accident. It just shows you how rooted you were in, I don't know, Ella's character or in the space, in the relational component of the story. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No, I get what you mean. I think that, you know, it's a combination of things. I there's so much written into the page that I wanted to explore and do. But, oh my God, once you start working with real people, just all these things that you can bring out and also discover once you're on location and have little moments, you know, and there was one thing that I thought was, that also came up in the way I didn't expect on the page, but when Jackie's in her classroom and she opens up her book on French treaties signed with, indigenous people.
Right. Right. Yep.
Amber hands her the note that says you have no choice. And I meant that as in just the relationship between, Jackie and Amber, but the way that note lands on this page.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I like jumped up from the monitor at that point and was like, oh my God, look at this moment that's happened here, that I didn't write exactly this way. I mean, I knew what was going to be in the book. We designed the book. I knew what it would say, but I didn't realize the note would link up to the book in the same way.
Well, and I think it's connected to for me, certainly, and I've seen the film only once and hoping to see it again, but I mean, that's connected to, I think, the last line in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of a thread. It's that, again, we're back to choice. We're back to intentionality. We're back to stepping into your future, you know, complicity, all those things. It's I think it's really lovely the way stuff like that just plays out. And I love what you said about, you know, there's so much on the page, but once you start working with real people, everything changes, right?
Yeah.
Which is so wonderful and delightful. And isn't that what the stuff of life is made of, you know?
Totally. That's what makes filmmaking so enjoyable. It's like you can't write necessarily on the page that there's going to be a specific sunset where the clouds part in a certain way and the sun comes out. Like sometimes you just find that when you're there on set, and it speaks to the film in such an incredible way that you couldn't have imagined. So, you know, I'm definitely, I'm big on prep and doing as much work before you shoot as possible, but it's really important to be open to those things, to be open to chance and just to explore, be open to exploring.
It's a great way to end. What a beautiful quote. There's quite a few, but that's a nice soundbite to end. We've been talking with Nicole Dorsey about her new film, Black Conflux. World premiere, I think, right, Nicole?
Yes, world premiere.
World premiere at TIFF, tiff.net. You can find out, I think, first showing, the first Saturday, I think.
No, first Friday.
The first Friday. So that'll be like your first sort of Q&A. Is that like your first big moment, right?
Yeah, that's it.
Live Q&A. Wow. All right. I can feel nerves already for you. What a pleasure. What a pleasure chatting with you today. Thanks so much for your time again. And it's NicoleDorsey.com, right? People want to find out a little bit more about you and the work that you're doing. And that's DorSey.com.
Great.
Nicole. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. You too.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.